From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made by a fraternity in the year 1924. Historian Carter G. Woodson, an alumnus of the University of Chicago, had spent years urging black civic organizations to promote the achievements of its members. He had attended public exhibits and events highlighting progress that black Americans had made since the end of slavery. And while he was impressed by the displays, he was inspired to do more. In 1924, he turned to the Brothers of Omega Psi Phi, his fraternity, and charged them to take up the work. And that year, they founded what they called Negro History and Literature Week, which was later renamed Negro Achievement Week. The success and outreach linked to the fraternity's efforts were significant, and Woodson challenged participants to do more still. He turned to the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which he had co-founded in 1912, deciding it would be responsible for promoting knowledge of black history. And in February 1926, he officially announced the creation of a Black History Week. According to the Association of the Study of African American Life and History, Woodson never viewed black history as a one-week affair. In a post about the origins of Black History Month, the association writes, quote, "He pressed for schools to use Negro History Week to demonstrate what students learned all year. In the same vein, he established a Black Studies Extension program to reach adults throughout the year. It was in this sense that blacks would learn of their past on a daily basis that he looked forward to the time when an annual celebration would no longer be necessary." Generations before Morgan Freeman and other advocates of all-year commemorations, Woodson believed that black history was too important to America and the world to be crammed into a limited time frame. He spoke of a shift from Negro History Week to Negro History Year in his time, end quote. And that brings us to the 1960s, when what they called Negro History Week officially became Black History Month. What would Woodson think of efforts and celebrations related to Black History Month in 2019? And what would he think about how lessons on black history are taught in schools, or, as the case may be, not taught? We can only speculate. But what we do know is that a number of local and national efforts are increasing awareness of the achievements of African Americans. We've seen several Rochester-based efforts just in the past 4 days, and we're going to talk about some of that this hour. It has inspired us. We'll also ask our guests how they think school systems can improve curricula related to African American studies and how to expand lessons beyond just Black History Month. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. And Tiana Magnon is really the reason that we're here. Editor-in-Chief of Open Mic Rochester, freelance reporter for WXXI News. It's always nice to have you here, first of all, thanks for taking the time. And just remind us real briefly why we decided to call you on Friday afternoon and say, you got to come in on Monday. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, that was very brief. Thanks, Megan. It was really interesting because we created a 28 Days of Black History Month project, and the format is actually on Instagram. It's multimedia because we recognize that, you know, as an online site, it's great to publish there, but our audience, by and large, is on social media. And if we want these facts to get to them, we have to deliver it straight to them. So it was really cool to see the excitement around that project because it is a lot of work. So it's cool to be here.
All right. There's a lot to talk about there. Also with us is Dr. Leslie Meyer Small, superintendent of the Brockport Central School District. Always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with us is Dr. Jason Willis, Director of African American Studies at the Rochester City School District. Welcome back to the program. Thank you.
Top of the afternoon.
And also thanks to Chris Thompson, who's an engineer, an activist, and a comedian. And frankly, I'm just here so you can read your tweet on the air that had me falling over last week. But nice to see you, by the way.
Nice to see you.
It's not just for your tweet. I know you're also doing some work in this regard this month. What's going on?
Okay, so I'm doing two things. Every day I decided I was going to tweet out and Insta out and Facebook out a fact about an individual, preferably living, who's pivotal in black history. And also I started a Buy Black Food campaign. So every Friday I'm encouraging people to go out either for lunch or dinner or whenever to a black-owned business in Rochester. And I encourage my friends from other places to do the same.
And because you make us think, but you also make us laugh. What had me laughing last week was your warning that if you're going to play, there's a certain drinking game you don't want to play this month. What's the drinking game you don't want to play?
So the exact tweet is, be safe this Black History Month. Don't make a drinking game out of how many people ask you when is White History Month, because you'll get alcohol poisoning. And sure enough, I got blocked the first day of Black History Month. So you know who you are. You probably hate listening to this right now. I'd like to say I'm sorry, but I don't like to lie.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. That tweet's out of the way. I'm going to say hello to producer Megan Mack behind the glass because this is the first day of our winter membership campaign. Hello, producer Megan Mack.
I got to follow Chris. Come on.
I know. It's hard
That's
to follow
unfair.
Chris. I know.
Well, yes, it is the first day of our February membership drive. We'll call it winter, although it feels like spring outside. And as we were talking about Black History Month, we get dozens upon dozens of pitches for this show every week. And Evan, you can speak to this too. We try to shy away from what we call calendar journalism.
Yep.
So it's, some kind of awareness month or something like that. And yes, we're doing a show right now on Black History Month because it's important. But also we talk about issues related to underrepresented voices on this program every week. We can do better. Everyone can do better. But we're trying. And we really value our efforts here and the people who are sitting in our studio right now. Our thanks to them. People who call in with suggestions. We want to be more aware of what's going on in the community. We want this to be a voice for the community. And if you support that and you value connections in the programming we bring you every day, now is the time to support us with your dollars. We are here because of you. 454-6300. You can call and talk to our volunteers. We'll get you on and off the phone very quickly. If you want to go online to WXXI.org, you can hit that Donate Now button so you don't have to miss any connections, any more jokes from Chris Thomas. Chris Thompson.
How
Sorry,
dare
Chris,
you.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm
now
banned.
You're in trouble.
I'm banned from the show. Chris Thompson. And we'll get you back to connections very shortly. 454-6300, and thank you so much.
Thank you. By the way, Chris Thompson has been on the show with Chris Thomas, and that was a nightmare for me. So that I actually want to read an email first, and I'm on to read this. It actually comes from the last hour, but I'm going to send this over to Dr. Leslie Myers-Small here. So I'm curious to know how you feel our districts are doing with teaching and whether we're teaching in a way that's moving away from what we would call really Eurocentric history or if that process is happening. And this email came last hour, right at the end of last hour, from a woman named Kate who was talking about her views coming to the United States as an immigrant. Let me just read this. She says, I'm an immigrant. I'm an educated Caucasian female from Canada. I've been in the United States since 1996. I've lived in the Midwest, the South, the East Coast, and now Rochester. I have not experienced the bias that comes with speaking a different language or having an obvious cultural appearance. However, even my Canadian accent gives me away at times. And when that happens, people actually change, some subtly, others not so subtly. And my personal opinion is that, as a general rule, Americans are very sheltered. Your education system is very narrow. You do not live with a worldview on most levels. That makes you afraid of even your closest neighbors to the north and south. You avoid what you are afraid of, and you are afraid of what you do not know. That's from Kate. Now, that was about a conversation about assimilation, what it means, immigration-related issues. But to me, it says if we've been teaching in a Eurocentric way, and history's been written by mostly white people, mm-hmm. I think Kate's email is on my brain here. Are we afraid of what we don't know? Do we not know? Like, do we not push to expand that? And are we changing how we write history, how we write the textbooks, what we're focusing on? Have you seen an evolution at all there?
I've seen a little bit of it, but I would absolutely agree with what she said. You know, unless it's something that is on your brain and it is important to you, you're not going to think about it because your experience has been very homogenous for a very long time. And I'll tell you, just with me coming to Brockport, and people know this, that I was the first woman of color to serve as the superintendent for a Monroe County school, and that happened in 2012. Monroe County allegedly is a very progressive, very open area, and that was very shocking to me when my friend Dr. Nelms reminded me of that. He said, Les, you're going to be the first woman of color. And so I think as the demographics are changing, certainly in communities on the student side, that and we're looking to try and change that on the staff side, we have to continue to push this notion or the importance of diversifying the curriculum and having culturally responsive and culturally integrated curriculum. And we can't just relegate it to this month. Today alone, I went into two elementary classrooms, mm-hmm. and I read to elementary students, and I read the story of Lonnie Johnston, who is the reason why we have the Super Soaker. He came out of Tuskegee Institute mm-hmm. and went on to do amazing things at NASA relative to studying Jupiter. And so, you know, I think there are different ways that we can get at it, and we have to take and make small steps. But I think we are starting to look more broadly and more globally about how do we make sure that all of history is told and that it's not just a homogenous a homogenous viewpoint of that. But for the longest time, that's all we knew. You know, we knew about Columbus. We knew about slavery. We studied during this month Harriet and Tubman and the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But we have to figure out ways to meaningfully connect notable individuals throughout the year. And I think we're slowly getting there. Certainly have not arrived, but we're slowly getting there.
The Super Soaker, by the way?
The Super Soaker.
Like the...
Yes.
Just the backyard soup.
Yes.
The water gun.
There should be like a national day for that.
Yes.
I support Super Soaker Day.
And the kids were just like, wow, this is so cool.
Yes.
So, but here's the cool part. We had the opportunity to talk about segregation because of the way that Lonnie entered this arena. We had the opportunity to talk about that years ago, people who looked like me would not be allowed into certain spaces. Mm-hmm. And with fourth grade innocence, a student said, but we need you, Dr. Myers-Small. You are important to our school community. So, I mean, it's just making those meaningful connections for kids and not beating them over the head with it, but helping them to understand contextually where things come from and helping them to understand that they don't know the complete story and that there's a lot to that. Mm-hmm. And there's a background to it.
Dr. Willis, how do you view the sort of the evolution of how history is? I know we've talked about it right here on this program, and it's an ongoing conversation. You know, what's the February 2019 view in your world there?
In my world, and I think the world of many folks who have a lens for this type of work, is understanding that there's going to be oppositional energies when it comes to not only Black History Month, but equality-based issues, civic engagement mm-hmm. and responsibility, and the contextual layers that proliferate kind of mm-hmm. from that epicenter. I know for us, it's really important to make sure that we're framing the discussion. So we hear a lot about cultural responsiveness. Here at Rochester City School District, the definition that we use for cultural responsiveness is cultural responsive teaching connects students' cultural knowledge, prior experiences, and performance styles to academic knowledge and intellectual tools in ways that legitimize what students already know. Mm-hmm. By embracing the sociocultural realities and histories of the students through what is taught and how it is taught, culturally responsive teaching and teachers negotiate the classroom cultures with their students that reflect communities where the students grow up and develop. Here's an important thing. In Rochester City School District, we teach 89.7% young students of color. So cultural responsiveness in Iceland is going to look very different than it does here in the city of Rochester. What happens is we oftentimes have individuals or groups of individuals who don't understand contextually what it is that you're talking about when you say cultural responsiveness. It is experiential learning. It is problem-based learning. It's all these teaching techniques that says, hey, I want to teach physics. I want to teach the arc, right? It's the arc of a jump shot. Then you take the kid to Mount Hope Bridge and you show them the mathematics and the science underneath that, because that is their reality. We need to be able to not teach and preach kind of from our vantage points, but do so in a way in which makes the experience of the child and the environment of the child part of the teaching and learning process.
Okay. Jana Manion, how do you go about it for Open Mic as you prepared for February and what you're doing with Open Mic Rochester?
Yeah.
How did you kind of undertake this? Because it's a... There's a lot of different ways you can go in 28 days here.
Yeah, I think two things. One, going back to what you both said, we had to make sure that the information that we were giving actually, you know, people were responding to. So one, we kind of assessed our audience. We have readers as young as 13, and then we have people who have entire doctorates in African American studies. So how are we serving this audience? And so we actually haven't set all 28 days in stone. Mm-hmm. We set the first 2 weeks in stone so that we could see what people are responding to. We're not just preaching to the people. If certain posts get more likes, for instance, then we'll do more music-related posts. I happen to be a very big policy and political nerd. And I understand that for a lot of people, that's not as interesting. So I'm not going to put those biases in this project, and it's 27 political leaders you should know about. So it's been great to just kind of see the feedback. Even the first few days, we started off with a very basic, you know, Langston Hughes piece. And that idea came from the fact that how many English students are reading his poetry now, but they don't even understand what he went through. The same thing for Rosa Parks. We made sure to put in there that when she was a kid, she saw the KKK march down her street. Mm-hmm. She saw her family, you know, protect the household. And so for us, it was about making these connections between, yes, you are a kid now, but these people don't exist in silos. these people led childhoods that were similar to yours. They saw their families fight for something, and it also comes with a lot of risk. The other important thing for us was just making it actually personable. A lot of times when you come to something like education, you have this tendency to kind of be highbrow with it. That's not going to work on Instagram. You have to hashtag. So at the end of the day, no matter how fancy your wording is, you still have hashtags that's going to take away. So it forced us to kind of come off of our high horse and go right to the people and say, Rosa Parks was born, blah, 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 and this is what happened. And so even when we get to the bombing of Tulsa, when we get to that, the bombing of Black Wall Street, breaking it down in a way that people understand, or the bombing of Birmingham, those four girls that died, that wasn't a unique instance. Helping people understand the context around it, that's been a major focus.
I thought the piece on Rosa Parks was really illuminating in a way that helps tell the story that, you know, so many Americans know, oh yeah, she's the one who didn't want to give up her seat on the bus, and then all of a sudden, you know, the world changed. I mean, it's really rudimentary. It's not, I know, we laugh at it because it's so surface level, but in so many ways, it wasn't an accident that it was Rosa Parks on that bus on that day, again, as she said, as you mentioned, through open mic and through your work here. It's not that she planned to get arrested, but this was not an accident. And this was someone who was very conscious of that. I just thought that was
well, the other side of it is that when people learn about her history and they learn about Claudette Colvin and they learn about the women before her, there's this instant idea to dismiss her as someone who kind of took this opportunity and ran with it. And you have to understand the context of that movement, how important visuals were for that movement. And all of this understanding within even Blackness, as we talk about Black History Month, what is Blackness to different people? And how does that define how we move as a community and even how we remember our own history?
Chris Thompson, a couple things here. So first of all, it's been a little while since you and I were in school. And I don't know, were you the kind of person who saw, you know, sort of the educational system in a way that disappointed you growing up? Were you sort of, I don't know, like a knucklehead student, weren't thinking that deeply at the time? Or because now, I mean, you're looking at a lot of the ways structurally this society is built. Mm-hmm. Did you think about it that way when you were growing up? Did you think, how come this is missing or this is missing? Or did that come later?
I think I came into it just like being in school. Mm-hmm. Originally, like, I'm an engineer now, but originally I wanted to be a graphic artist. And I was doing everything I needed to do to be a graphic artist in high school. But, like, when it came to the time of college, like, there were a lot more things going on in my life. Like, my senior year, I was homeless. And I was thinking, is it practical to be a graphic artist right now? Or should I try to go with, you know, engineering, because that will get me, you know, that'll give me a steady income, you know, within 4 years compared to being a graphic artist, you know, there's no telling. So I was focused a lot more on the practicality of school. And even then I turned down taking an AP US history course to take the one Black history course that we had at our school. I'm thankful for that. I kind of wish I took the AP U.S. History too, but it was impossible.
How do you view now that it's been a little time, are you aware, or at least are you feeling like there's been much movement to change in terms of how history is taught in American schools?
General history, no.
Yeah.
But there's still the segregation of history that's really frustrating. Like, you can find, like, in Asian American history course or a Hispanic American history course, and of course a Black history course, but there's not much impetus to, like, emphasize that these different types of history are all still American history. Like, we've been here since the birth of the nation and haven't gotten credit for helping build the nation, involuntarily, mind you. And that's the same thing, like, the same thing could be said of any other culture. Like, there was basically, like, what happened in Tulsa, the Tulsa riots, that happened in California to Chinese Americans, you know? That was, like, I believe it was about 30 years after, or maybe 30 years before. I can't remember exactly. But that happened to them. And when it comes to Hispanic Americans, like, you know, they were natives at first. They mingled with Europeans. Like, there's a whole history that we've been ignoring and not incorporating into American history, just American history that needs to be told. So
that last point is also really salient, piggybacking on the last hour, just because when you think about history of this country, it's such a big geographical area.
Oh, yeah.
And yet we're so Eurocentric, it's almost like the Eurocentric approach is that Hispanic history is kind of, well, another history or part of our history, or as opposed to something that has always been here and integrated in different ways. I think there's so many layers to this.
I can add.
Yeah, please.
I would add, though, we don't even teach American history that well. I mean, how many people you know who actually understand how the First World War started? So it could be as simple as talking about the Vietnam War and helping people understand how many black soldiers risked their lives for this war. But I would say it's sometimes frustrating to criticize how we handle black history, knowing that in general the American education system has dropped the ball when it comes to history or social studies, period.
Well, and so now you're focusing this month on mostly, what, living leaders or figures who are alive now. Why did you
yes.
want to do that?
Well, it started out because we all know what happened before slavery. We know what happened, like, right after slavery. And people always focus on that, like, during Black History.
I think to Janet's point, I'm not sure we know it all that well anyway, but go.
Oh, no, you're right. I think, like, us in the room,
yeah.
basically. But, like, I was thinking about it, and, like, there are a lot of firsts that have happened, like, just in this century mm-hmm. and just in the 20th century. Like, Simone Biles is the most awarded U.S. gymnast. No, most awarded gymnast in the world. And people don't know that. And this is a black woman who lives right now. She is she's literally a living legend, you know. My first tweet was about Missy Elliott, and I thought it was going to be just a silly tweet, but you know, people like responded to it tremendously. She had 2 gold albums, she had 5 platinum albums, produced over 100 songs that were hits, 100. And then she became the first female rapper to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I would wager that you could say she won the 2015 Super Bowl. Like, straight up. Like, she was there. She stopped the show. And, like, she's an amazing woman. And people didn't realize all this. You know, these are people who live right now. And even if I go back to, like, the 20th century, it was a black woman who took down Lucky Luciano. That was a black lawyer, Eunice Carter. I don't remember her middle name. I got to Google it. But, I mean, these are people who were around in the 20th and 21st century that people just don't think about. Like, we're making firsts, like, all the time, and people don't realize that.
On the Simone Biles thing, just a brief perspective from everyone in the room, the fact that Michael Phelps is a household name in this country and Simone Biles is well known, I'm not sure. There's probably polar data out there. There's no doubt that Michael Phelps is known more than Simone Biles in this country, despite the fact that Simone Biles, as you've said, is one of the most remarkable and remarkably decorated athletes ever.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a component of race to that?
And gender.
Yeah. And gender.
And age.
Loaded baked potato. Yeah. Well, I mean, let's just take yes to all of those, you know. We have an opportunity to be more clear and acute with how we use language in order to describe, right? Westward expansion sounds nice. Westward exploitation sounds divisive. Which one was more likely the reality? Just in the Missouri Compromise, we found 500,000 bones of people that were slaughtered. Hip bones, femurs, right? But that's not the reality of the history we tell, right? We know what happened when Texas and the annexation. We have this, these are documented experiences, right? The spin doctors are alive. And so when you talk about a Michael Phelps versus Simone Biles, right, we have instances in history where we've seen this pattern before. When Malcolm X originally talked about by any means necessary, it wasn't a violent message. It was about economic equality. You do this job and get paid this dollar. I do the same job, I should get paid the same dollar. We recognize the reason and rationale why Colin Kaepernick knelt. Not against military, not against the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines.
Not against the flag.
he knelt for a very specific reason and front-loaded the messaging, and it still was able to be, the minutiae of the details were able to be maneuvered, right? So that's something that, if we tie, Mary, two things that you talked about today, you opened the show talking about being afraid of what we do not know, and in so many ways, it not being an accident. There's a reason our young folks don't know their history. That's not an accident. There's five people that they teach across five kind of different messaging, even though it's a collective message, and then the story oftentimes stops. When you take slavery, right, if we're talking about textbook publication, in Texas, we know Texas drives our public publications. You're trying to take out the word slavery, right? What does that do over time and space to a group of people? Mm-hmm. What does that do over time and space to the understanding or the knowledge base or the foundational understandings of our youth who we're so vested in when they do something wrong, but we're not working actively to have them find themselves in the context of their environment, right? You're not teaching what their true identity is, and we give them whatever the running media definition of them is in that space. And those are juxtapositions that that kids can reduce from, too.
That, see what you've done with your work there? Where can people find what you're doing on a daily basis this month?
Every day about 9 a.m. At Crons of Non, my Twitter account, my Instagram account, same name. If you're friends with me on Facebook, you can see it there, but I'm kind of selective with my friends right now on there, on that platform.
Okay.
But, yeah, Instagram and Twitter, at Crons of Non.
And Open Mic Rochester, people can see daily
history.
Yeah, just
go on our Instagram, Open Mic ROC. That's it. Super easy to find.
We have some phone calls I want to work through. Bruce, Bernard, Calvin, let's go ahead and get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. You just heard Dr. Jason Willis, Director of African American Studies for the Rochester City School District. Dr. Leslie Meyer Small is here, Superintendent of the Brockport Central School District. Tiana Magnon, Editor-in-Chief of Open Mic Rochester and a freelance reporter for WXXI News. And Chris Thompson, who is an engineer, an activist, a comedian, and a guy who's making us laugh and think, and a lot to think about. Let's get that only break and right back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, New York State's libraries are facing another round of funding cuts. We'll explore what the potential impact could be on patrons, including those in rural communities, where a significant number of families do not have internet access. Then in our second hour, we explore the literary history of upstate New York with a local blogger named Stephen Huff. He visited authors' graves in 35 communities across the state. Fascinating stuff. Talk with you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. Chris was just mentioning where to find it again. Do it again.
Oh, yeah. At Crons of Non, it's spelled CHRONSOFNON.
All right, Crons of Non.
Yep.
As in Chronicles of Nonsense.
Correct.
I hope all of our callers hang in there because I want to get through every one of these calls. I'm going to start with Calvin in Rochester. Go ahead, Calvin.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Tiana and Chris.
Hi, Calvin.
And everyone on the panel. I wanted to echo some comments Tiana had earlier, and Dr. Jason? I apologize if I missed your
Yep, Dr.
Your
Jason
name.
Willis, yep.
Yeah, and talking about, you know, it's important that everyone understands, and we actually just posted a blog post on our platforms about how, you know, Black history doesn't begin with slavery in America, nor does it end with the Civil Rights Movement, and so in our discussion this month, I run 540 West Main, .org and our platforms, we're, you know, also trying to help everyone understand that Black history is much bigger than just America. You know, there's history, there's kings, there's queens, there's Mesopotamia, there's ancient Egyptian history that is all part of the narrative, and it's so important, especially as educators, that in the positions of power that we have, that we continue to drive home the point that our history does not begin with this sort of just awful, you know, being taken from tribes and villages in Africa, but there was so much before that and so many contributions that the African diaspora has made possible for the entire world that often doesn't get discussed while we're discussing Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and all of the other important figures that we know in American public education. And so we don't have to teach these things mutually exclusive of each other. We can talk about them in tandem because we really have to understand the bigger global historical perspective that happened much before transatlantic slave trade. And so often, you know, me being a product of public education, that's never been taught. Like, I never remember a teacher talking about ancient Egyptian history or Mesopotamia or any of the civilizations that quite literally contributed the math that we know, the medicine that we know. That doesn't get discussed unless, you know, you're an adult doing that research on your own, and that's the problem. And so I really love the work that Open Mic is doing with Tiana at the helm of that. And also we have a class tomorrow at 540 West Main explicitly talking about Black history did not begin with slavery at 6:30 at our flagship location on West Main Street. So everyone is open to attend that, and we'll really dig in and dive in to the history before America.
So, Calvin, before I let you go, where can people find you online?
Yeah, we're at 540westmain.org, and our Instagram, Twitter, et cetera, is 540westmain the same. So thank you all for the work that you're doing and making this a conversation that happens not just this month, but every single month.
All right, Calvin, thank you very much. I want to turn to Dr. Meyer Small for this, because this is a case, and I think Dr. Willis as well here, but this is a case where Calvin is looking beyond this limited set of what the American system is viewed as Black history and saying that there's so much that's left out. And it's undeniably true, and it's also undeniable that teachers will say, well, I only have so much time.
Sure.
I have tests we have to give. How do we start to sort of move that within the constraints of time, within the constraints of testing? The mm-hmm. testing aspect, too, I think probably makes it very difficult and very limiting. So it feels like there's a lot of earth that has to shake before we see really, really big changes here.
Mm-hmm.
Or am I wrong?
No, you're correct. I think it's looking at it in slightly different ways. We certainly need to look at the curriculum, and that's a conversation with the Commissioner of Education and our Board of Regents. That's how that information gets changed. And certainly shifting the paradigm of what specifically gets tested, is important relative to curricular and academic advocacy. But there's more to school than just kids going to their classes. Again, like, I'm going in and reading, and I'm working with our library media specialists. So when we do read alouds with kids, what's the type of information and material are we presenting? Choosing the different guest speakers, the folks who come to do presentations in the schools, making sure that it reflects a diverse repertoire of individuals and doesn't represent a homogenous population. There's different ways that you can get at it, and not just solely of what gets taught in reading, writing, and arithmetic. The different books that you choose, the authors. You know, when I was doing my dissertation work, we were encouraged to make sure that we looked at research that reflects all the research and not just from what traditionally and seminally has been looked at. So you can really attack and address this from a variety of ways.
Okay. Dr. Willis?
I absolutely co-sign everything that Dr. Meyer Small has expressed. I think in addition to that, and in a similar vein, we're looking for access points, right? So in Rochester City School District, we know the 7th, 8th grade doesn't have state-level testing, and so we can do some universal curriculum infusions, right? We can build up the composite knowledge and not have teachers feel as if they're up against pacing charts, curriculum mandates, so on and so forth. We also know we have a significant number of teachers that don't mirror the population of students that they teach, right? So it's not a pink elephant in the room. The data bears that out. And with that, you're going to have levels of mistrust, levels of miscommunications, and levels of misunderstanding. Professional development is an opportunity where you can go in and begin to influence people, expose them to different things that maybe they don't have the foundational knowledge on. I think that Dr. Meyer Small is acutely aware of the type of people that we bring into our school buildings. We use, I know, underneath the umbrella of Department of African-American Studies, Rochester City School District, the U of R MMLA mentors, mm-hmm. which are in the Simon Business School at University of Rochester. We use their PIECES team, which is a female mentorship group, and we deploy them in critical areas, schools that have high levels of human capital, schools potentially in receivership, and understanding the importance of the imagery of a person of color for our young folks in K through 6. Johns Hopkins just put out a report We're not even talking about a good teacher. We're just talking about a teacher. One black male teacher between grades 3 and 6 is 29% more graduation in critical populations, right? Young people of color. Just having that experience. So now, what processes are we putting in play? What ways in which are we discussing with HR so that we can boost that type and bolster that type of recruitment? Because we know that it's going to have outcome-based measures that will reflect positivity in our community and for our students.
Chris, Tiana, you want to add to what you heard from Calvin as well?
No, I thought we had more callers.
Okay. we've got plenty more to get to. I want to make sure everyone gets a chance here. This is Bernard in Fairport next. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, thank you. I'm blind, so I have a different view of black. And my question is really is that if you teach a kid about the history of the black, are you not basically, I don't know, making that important to them? And what I mean by that is when they go out to live, don't they get shouldn't they be given some kind of opportunity to, you know, take the advantages of being black, but not thinking about it all of the time and trying to come up with excuses for it or whatever? So, you know, I can appreciate the focus on the history on one hand, but does that not trying to make the history black only, or however you want to phrase it, is that not the wrong thing to teach? I'm sorry about this. It's just, I just can't imagine, you know, when I would go to hire somebody, I'd hire them on a phone. I wouldn't know what their color was, and I wouldn't care. So that's my point. Are you over-quoting the color, making it too important to these young kids? Just my point. Thank you very much.
Okay, Bernard, thank you. Dr. Willis wants to start. I think everyone wants to jump in here.
I'll just speak to it for a moment. One, I very much appreciate your reality, and I appreciate the lens in which and the lane in which you're asking a question. One of the things that we hear oftentimes, I know within my professional motif that I hear, is a rationale of being colorblind, right, versus color conscious. And I think that in the United States of America, understanding our very colorful past, to walk into situations and to articulate that we are being colorblind, we don't see color in children, it doesn't provide the level of merit for them to express what their very real feelings are, and also what our responsibilities are for the level of denial in which we're saying that we don't see color. If their experience is rich, if they are valid as human beings, and they express disdain, discomfort, or any other adjective to that regard, we need to honor them in their space. This is a consistent pattern of behavior and of dialogue that we've heard from people of color, not only post-transatlantic slave trade, but throughout history holistically.
I would add, I think that perspective also sees blackness as a negative, as if we've only ever overcome all of these negative things. But there has also been a lot of amazing things that have happened in black history. And the problem with not recognizing that history is that, sure, you may not know the bad things, which why wouldn't you want to know? But you also don't know the good things. And so I'm thinking as a young black woman, how empowering it is to see women of all different abilities, all different ages, all different skin tones stand up and fight. Because when I'm in a position where maybe I feel the desire to be quiet or I don't feel like my voice matters, I have literal women throughout history that I can point to empower myself to speak out. I would also say that giving our children that history, it actually supplements what they're going through, going back to what Dr. Jason was saying. They're going to have these experiences regardless. And so equipping them with the language, the different, you know, skills that they need to actually get through this and understand that the world that they're operating in and how to actually be successful, that's all part of Black History Month. It's not just talking about what we've been through, but informing ourselves of where we want to go and how we get there as well.
There's a quote I love that says, it's hard to be it if you can't see it, right? And going along with what you just said, I know along my trajectory, had I not known about Dr. Alice Holloway Young and her significant contributions to the world of education, there are times when I did feel like I can't do this anymore. It's too stressful. I give up. Knowing that somebody who was in a different time period, who went through many more challenges than I've ever experienced, she overcame them and became successful was critical. Knowing about the contributions of Dr. Walter Cooper and his significant presence in the world of physics and science and all of the things that he has accomplished. When I was a student at the University of Rochester, knowing he trampled the same path and I'm walking in footsteps that he laid before me, was critically important for me to know while I was a pre-med student, you know what, I can do it because someone else before me did it. So knowing or teaching kids about their history and understanding where they have come from is socially and emotionally important for their development. I can't tell you the number of times when I walk into schools, and not all students, but particularly students of color, when they see me, they're just like, wow, there is somebody who leads our school district who looks like me. And you know what? There's an alternative path. I just don't have to aspire to be a basketball player or an entertainer or a rapper, where there's nothing wrong with that, because I recently took up rapping, right, with my
ice
right. But I have a young lady right now who's in our urban suburban program who wants to be a superintendent of schools, and to me that is so powerful and so significant about her own growth and development. So learning about people who are different from you are critical for all of our students, but particularly for our students of color.
And I'll just interject here. Our young folks sometimes don't articulate in the way in which we are ready to receive information, mm-hmm. but they mm-hmm. are talking to us. So when they say they want to be Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, Little Uzi Vert, Big Crit, they're really saying, these are the people that made it out of a situation mm-hmm. very similar to me, and they bought a house for their mom, right? Mm-hmm. They want the American way. They want the bandwidth to change their trajectory in a moment's notice in sure. order to be able to be independent in capacities that they previously have no understanding of. And that is the only vision that they have of people that have made it through mediums, social media, TV, right? So that's a separate context. The last thing is, you know, for educators, for people working with children, I went into one of our schools. Young man came up to me, you know, sharp brother, all types of sharp, just a clean cut, tall, strong, looks me in his eye, says, you look like money. Now, he's not trying to tell me that I literally look like money. He's trying to find something, because he can recognize in my spirit there's probably little he can offer me, is what he's thinking, right? What can I say mm-hmm. to make this guy know how much I appreciate his presence in my school building right now? You look like money, because mm-hmm. he thinks I value money, right? If I'm just walking about, oh, good looking, and go on about my day, or thanks so much, and go on about my day, mm-hmm. I missed the blessing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Dr. Willis, why do you care so much? So you recognize that I care? So you recognize that I'm somewhere at the top of the list of people that do care? So you appreciate the sustainability behind my level of care, right? Are we listening, or are we listening to respond? If we're listening, then our students are talking to us, right? Our young folks are talking to us, right? The calibrations of our ancestors, right, through our elders down to us, it's all we're listening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Chris?
I appreciate what the caller was saying, and I kind of understand what he was saying, but, like, that train of thought, like, it's fine to, like, not judge anybody on, you know, their skin color, which is great, but, like, the train of thought that, like, only learning Black history this month is going to go down some road, that's kind of like the train of thought that people use when they say that Black folks are always in a state of victimhood, which isn't true. And also, like, this is the month that we're trying to show you that we're not in a state of victimhood, because we're trying to show you our triumphs. Like, there are so many great Black folks, there are so many great Africans in the past that have done things and are still doing things now. So, like, focusing on this is, like, essentially just filling that gap that we've missed, because American history has been whitewashed, like, in this country. Like, the fact, just like we were talking about, like, the Texas School Board is the group of people who are, like, trying to take, you know, trying to euphemize slavery, trying to euphemize things, and then, like, erase the efforts and the triumphs that Black folks have done all this time. So focusing 1 month, it's only 4 weeks. It's not that bad. Like, we've been dealing, we still have to, like, you know, learn white history even during Black History Month. So all 12 months, you know, mm-hmm. 4 weeks of focus to fill a gap that we've been missing all this time. I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I'm just an observation because Bernard's a somewhat regular caller. I would just say, you know, I mean, and I know Chris has kind of riffed on this in the past. You're not a big fan of hearing when people say, well, I don't see color. Well, yes, you do. But Bernard is saying, I'm literally blind. I can't see color. And therefore, you know, I have a sense of it. But I would also say to Bernard, you know, with respect, just because you're blind doesn't mean that you're, I mean, you're one of the smarter people who's called this program. You understand mm-hmm. oppression. You understand mm-hmm. when people have faced discrimination. And I go back to the start of the program. We mentioned Carter G. Woodson. I can't speak for Carter G. Woodson, but I would say Woodson said the goal was not to have to do this 1 month or 1 week out of the year. The goal was to have just a better teaching of history that was comprehensive, and that because it wasn't happening, it felt like the need was, we better do something. Eventually, maybe we won't need to. And I think that's more of mm-hmm. at least some of the roots of it. So.
In our history books, we teach ancient Mesopotamia as a Fertile Crescent. The Nile River, Fertile Crescent, the cultural diffusion, the transportation, mm-hmm. the very rich ground, it was 3,000, 4,000, 6,000 years before, right? So if we contextualize it, it doesn't make the ground any less fertile, right? But it's where is it, right? How is it? How is this experience meant to enrich the lives of the folks that it's being delivered to, right? It's about the deliverables.
Well, in our last few minutes here, let me at least just ask our guests before we go here, if you think... Well, I guess based on Bernard's call, I don't think we're very close to not needing Black History Month. I mean, again, Woodson talked about that, having, you know, just Black History Year, because it feels like White History Year every year, as Chris Thompson said. Doesn't feel like we're close to that right now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm still seeing that people are not, like, listening when we speak our stories. And like we're speaking our own personal histories, we're speaking histories of other people, and people are still not listening that this is like part of your history. Like this is part of you. If you're an American and you're like bristling at Black History Month, then like give up everything that Black folks have contributed to you. Give up your internet.
Heart machine.
Yep, give up your heart machine. If you've had laser eye surgery, you know, just I don't know. I don't know. You can't put cataracts back. But, like, Black folks have contributed all of this to history. We've contributed to the economy of the U.S.
Give up your super soaker.
Yeah, give up your super soaker. give up squirt guns, you know. Like, there's so many things that we've contributed to this society that has gone... like unseen, or we just like take it for granted. Like your touchstone phone, in fact, you know, a Black woman helped pave the way for touchstone phones to be a thing. So, you know, I can look at anything in this room and see our history in it.
Even in phones, if we understand how cobalt is mined, right? We know that it's two African children's per every one new phone that die, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a global connection to all of the experiences and all of the ways in which, right, the lives and the lived experiences of people contribute, right? It's easy to just go in, turn on my phone, walk into Apple and say, but if you saw the faces of the two kids, would that change your ability to, would that change your methodology, right? And this is common information, right? Mm-hmm. Just go to YouTube, Google search it, it's there for you.
I think about the point Chris Thompson was just making. If you think about what inventors you know, you can think of a few. If you think about what the points Chris was making about what scientists who are Black and inventors mm-hmm. have contributed, we are less likely to know. And then I'm connecting that to what Dr. Willis was saying about, well, if a young student is talking about a rapper or a basketball star, often in the media portrayal, that's who, you know, sort of mm-hmm. our media elevates to prominence, less the names that Chris is talking about. And it looks like the paths are narrower. And there's a little bit of perception becomes reality until we change the reality and change the teaching of the history. I'm just trying to do some student work and connect the threads you've all brought in. Go ahead, Tiana.
Yeah, I would add that it's also very important that we don't make Black History Month about accomplishments, because that automatically reduces the Black community to people who had the wealth to accomplish these things, the ability, that's another thing, or even sometimes the gender. At one point, gender was a very big issue on whether you could do anything even as a Black person. So going back to what we were saying just a second ago, I don't see a future where we don't have Black History Month. I don't care how integrated it becomes, but I see that for all nationalities. You know, I think it's important to have Native American History Month and Hispanic History Month. But on the basis of theory, if we're going to be a pluralist society, then you have to teach these things both together, but also individually. You can't have an America where we're all a melting pool and we're not actually learning about each other. It's not a real pluralist society in that regard.
What I'll add is I think given contemporarily what's going on, if you look at what's going on in Virginia right now, if you look at Kaepernick taking a knee, if you look at even what's the politics, how they're unfolding in D.C., we have an opportunity to capitalize on those events and then work back to say, why are people angry about what's going on in Virginia relative to the blackface, and giving a historical context to that, right? So it right now, just the way that things are playing out in the media, in the news, it gives us a rich opportunity to talk about these issues, which are critical.
Dr. Meyer Small, always good to have you. Thank you for being here. Nice to have Dr. Willis. Thank you, Dr. Willis. Thanks for being here as well.
Pleasure was mine.
Our thanks to Tiana Mignone from Open Mic Rochester. One more time, where people can follow along with Open Mic.
Instagram, Open Mic ROC.
All right, a lot of education this month. And Chris Thompson, where they can follow along with you.
At Crons of None on Twitter and Instagram.
Crons of None as in Chronicles of Nonsense. Crons of
Correct.
None. Thank you for being here as well. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. You are now free to go outside and enjoy this beautiful weather, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.